lawmakers from the four Catalan pro-independence parties with the support of Òmnium Cultural, a grassroots organization whose leader was found guilty of sedition in the 2017 referendum trial and sentenced to 9 years in jail.
We brought forward the amnesty law as a starting point for a democratic solution. If the government really believes that the repression exerted in Catalonia was a mistake, it should adopt the amnesty law as a way to correct that mistake.
Spain's ruling Socialist Party had dismissed the amnesty bill even before it reached Congress.
We have always expressed opposition against amnesty. We're always willing to accept particular cases and in accordance with the legal framework. But we have never opted for such an amnesty that undoubtedly has much more political character of acquittal.
The socialists say they favor other solutions to amnesty, namely a presidential pardon or a reform of the sedition law that sentenced the jailed Catalan leaders to up to 13 years behind bars. For the separatists, neither of these proposals addresses the hundreds of independence-related legal cases they claim are pending trial in Spain's courts.
With the amnesty bill doomed to fail from the outset, the fate of jailed leaders now goes down the path of either clemency or the reform of Spain's criminal code. A slow and winding path that even the most optimistic in Catalonia say it will lead nowhere. Cusay Kedri, Barcelona.
The second Tehran Dialogue Forum was held virtually, but the messages were as strong as last year's. Foreign ministers of Iran, Turkey, and Afghanistan discussed the latest major issues in the Middle East, from terrorism to the U.S. destabilizing presence in the region. Iranian Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif made the opening speech, where he touched on the U.S. intervention in the region, saying Washington has spent billions of dollars on its military sector only to perpetuate insecurity in the region.
The U.S. has exacerbated the insecurity and instability of this region more than any other region. As its own figures suggest, some $7 trillion have been wasted on forever wars and military interventions in this region.
Zarif also censured the U.S. for keeping its anti-Iran sanctions amid the pandemic, calling the measures an economic war waged against the Iranian people.
U.S. coercive economic measures directed against the Iranian people, especially at a time of pandemic, are nothing less than economic warfare. And as we now witness, there has been yet no difference in following a failed policy of the so-called maximum pressure between the former and the current U.S. president.
Echoing Zarif's remarks, Turkish Foreign Minister Mevlut Cavusoglu also rejected the unilateral U.S. sanctions against Iran, saying Ankara supports a U.S. return to the 2015 Iran nuclear deal and its full implementation.
From the very beginning, we have stood alongside Iran against unilateral sanctions. And Turkey has always supported the full implementation of the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. Now we support the new U.S. administration's declared intention to return to the deal. And we are hopeful that a mutually acceptable formula will be found to revive the JCPOA.
Afghan Foreign Minister Hanif Atmar was another diplomat at the virtual meeting who said his country should not become a safe haven for terrorists.
It's important for the region and for the outside world to realize the fact that outside problems should not be fought over on Afghan soil.
Tehran Dialogue Forum held its first edition last year with the presence of senior officials and heads of research institutes from different countries. The aim is to discuss views on major developments in sensitive areas, including the Persian Gulf and West Asia.
It seems that the trilateral meeting boils down to a single message. Three major countries in the region, Iran, Turkey, and Afghanistan, believe that it's time for the U.S. to stop its problematic behavior in West Asia. They say it can start by leaving the region and its people alone. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
We'll be right back.
figures suggest some $7 trillion have been wasted on forever wars and military interventions in this region.
The top Iranian diplomat underlined that the U.S. interventions are aimed at dominating the region. He said the region has turned into a military zone for the U.S. and its allies through their troop presence and arms sales to certain states. Addressing the Tehran Dialogue Forum, Syria's Foreign Minister Faisal Miqdad highlighted the U.S. occupation of his country. He said that Washington formed a coalition under the pretext of fighting terrorism, but its main agenda was to attack Syria and threaten other regional countries.
The United States and the European Union, or the leading countries in the European Union, are using this coalition to attack Syria, to threaten other independent countries in the region, and to claim that they are fighting against Daesh. Daesh, in fact, has been encouraged and supported by the United States.
Years of devastation in Syria caused by the U.S. and its allies with their backing to terror groups are just the tip of the iceberg. U.S. interventionist agenda in other countries such as Iraq, Afghanistan, Yemen, and Libya all show that Washington wants to destabilize West Asia to dominate it. However, such stance has simply ignited anti-U.S. sentiment across many countries. In Iraq, protests against the presence of American troops and a parliamentary resolution for the expulsion of all U.S. troops last year are part of the sentiment. Calls grew louder after the U.S. assassination of top Iranian General Qasem Soleimani and Iraqi commander Abu Mahdi al-Mohandes in a drone attack in January last year. The U.S. too has come to a conclusion that its West Asia policies have been a complete failure. Last week, the U.S. government, for the first time, acknowledged that the Yemen war has no military solution. Secretary of State Antony Blinken also told U.N. Special Envoy for Yemen, Martin Griffiths, that diplomatic efforts should be redoubled with the help of the U.N. and other players to end the Yemen war. But shouldn't Washington be blamed for the Yemen carnage, as it's been the main supplier of arms to Saudi Arabia and its allies that invaded the impoverished nation? But the U.S. views the West Asia region as a military zone, and what matters to Washington most is making profit out of chaos and conflicts, for it can sell more weapons to the rich Arab states.
Nowruz is the most widely celebrated holiday in the Islamic Republic of Iran. It means new day that marks the first day of spring. The holiday, which usually falls on or around March 21st, is widely celebrated across the West and Central Asia. Iran's foreign ministry invited the envoys of the Nowruz region to mark the event. Held in the presence of ambassadors, Iran's foreign minister Mohammad Javad Zarif congratulated the arrival of spring.
On Darsinas.
The lesson that all must learn is that there is only a superpower in the world, and that is the Almighty God. There is no other superpower in the world. Those who were boasting of their military, economic, and scientific power all were defeated by a tiny virus.
Iran's Minister of Cultural Heritage, Tourism, and Handicrafts, Ali Asghar Mounesan, and Minister of Science, Research, and Technology, Mansour Ghulami, also attended the ceremony and made a short speech. Mexico's ambassador to Tehran said, Nowruz is very similar to traditions in Mexico.
La verdad es que estoy muy, muy conmovido.
Nowruz is very interesting to me. Few people in Mexico know about this celebration. I see a very happy atmosphere in Tehran, especially since you are apparently entering the new century. Another thing that caught my attention is the human relations that take place during the Nowruz celebrations, which is very similar to the celebrations in Mexico. For example, the whole family goes shopping for New Year here, and it is the same way in Mexico.
Some traditional musical bands from across Iran performed some pieces for the visitors. A half-seen sofra was also set in the iconic Mashq Square to mark the festivity of Nowruz. The message of Nowruz, which is revival and a new life, was also projected on a historic building inside the ministry complex via video mapping.
Over 300 million people celebrate Nowruz across the globe. In Iran, it is the most important holiday that marks the beginning of the new year. Nowruz has been celebrated in Iran for over 3,000 years. Humam Abedi, Tehran.
We'll be right back. paid over the policing of a London vigil on March 13th for Sarah Everard, a 33-year-old woman allegedly kidnapped and murdered by a serving British police officer earlier this month, is ongoing. What had been a peaceful and respectful demonstration of female solidarity turned ugly. Police moved in, pushing and shoving the demonstrators, and took away some of the women in handcuffs.
I've never been in a situation like this before, so I just thought, well, if I just don't say anything, I'm not sure what to do. But, you know, I just stood there, and I know someone was, a police officer was pulling my arm, trying to get my name, and then all of a sudden, I was tackled to the ground.
The sight of women who had come to stand together against male violence being manhandled led to a chorus of criticism from across the political spectrum. Attention soon shifted to this woman, Metropolitan Police Commissioner Cressida Dick, forced to explain her officer's actions to the authorities and to defend herself.
I don't think anybody who was not in the operation can actually pass a detailed comment on the rightness and wrongness of it.
She has so far rejected calls for her resignation from those she described as armchair critics who believe police handling of the vigil was heavy-handed. But she has the backing of the government. Prime Minister Boris Johnson says he has full confidence in her. In fact, the force she leads may be getting the powers she asked for after the Extinction Rebellion protests of 2019, a new law and order bill. Critics, among them conservative MPs, have called it a mess and an attack on people's right to protest.
300 or so pages, 170-something clauses, and almost nothing, if you can believe it, on violence against women and girls. The gaping hole in this bill is why we'll be voting against it.
The main focus of the criticism of the bill is its wording. For example, it gives the police the power to impose conditions on processions and public assemblies if the noise generated by the persons taking part may result in serious disruption to the activities of an organization which are carried out in the vicinity.
I'm really worried about it. It gives the police a lot of powers to decide what they think is an unacceptable protest, powers that can be decided later in law. It's not very clear. Just their conception of what might be a public annoyance or nuisance is potentially going to be a reason to shut down a protest and for prison sentences of up to 10 years. That's a bit of an assault on democracy.
Just imagine going to jail for making noise or causing inconvenience. The British government will have some tough questions to answer from MPs on its new policing bill, such as how it defines such unspecified terms as noise or serious inconvenience, and how giving sweeping, ill-defined powers to the police will affect freedom of expression in this country. Saeed Pourreza, London.
Based on a report by Afghanistan's Independent Human Rights Commission, over 100 civilians, including women and children, were killed or wounded over the last 6 days alone. The rights body called international community to put pressure on both warring sides, mainly the Taliban, to reduce violence.
As our findings show, 13 civilians, including women and children, were killed and 93 others were wounded due to rising violence across the country only over the past 6 days. Therefore, we seriously call on the international community and other rights bodies to do whatever they can to put an end to misery of war-weary Afghans.
This comes as both the Afghan government and the Taliban accuse each other of targeting civilians, but facts on the ground showed that terrorist groups such as Daesh and Taliban are responsible for much of civilian casualties.
There are multiple reasons in civilian casualties, such as terrorist attacks, the proxy wars, or unknown elements that are still in equations. But the war in Afghanistan is a complicated and bland as ever. People are still dying, life is still being torn apart, and the nation, global powers, most importantly, the people of Afghanistan are being drawn further into a situation that is hard to see ahead of it.
However, the NATO troops are also accused of targeting civilian gatherings, such as wedding parties and religious events. This comes as despite all political attempts to bring stability to Afghanistan, this is the Afghans who rarely bear the brunt of violence. Local Afghans say they welcome any agreement that leads the country to calm and security.
Afghan civilians lose their lives on a daily basis while the country's peace process is going to enter a new phase. The launch of separate summits in Russia and Turkey to discuss the fate of the peace process. Will those conferences bring peace to Afghanistan? Let's wait and see. Sayed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
The immense bloc of anti-aggression parties has held a symposium in the capital Sana'a to discuss the repercussions of the Takfiri organization's presence in the country. It comes as the army pushes its offensive to liberate the province of Marib from terrorist groups.
This event is to inform the Yemenis of the danger of the foreign presence and terrorist organizations, especially in the southern governorates, and it coincides with the continuing battle of Marib, which has led to mass flight of terrorists from areas previously controlled by Saudi Arabia and the UAE.
The participants in the symposium said foreign forces, including those of Saudi Arabia and the UAE, are the main supporters of the terrorists in different parts of the country. The participants called for purging Marib from Takfiri terrorists.
Everyone knows that the terrorism in the Arab world is rooted in the Wahhabi ideology and is waged with the support of Saudi Arabia. The country is still the center of terrorism, and other countries have joined it, trying to spread these ideas among Muslims. The US and Britain are sponsoring these terrorists and exploiting them against axes of resistance to spread chaos in countries which oppose US policies in the region.
Saudi Arabia has led a U.S.-backed aggression on Yemen since the beginning of 2015 that has killed tens of thousands of Yemenis and has also unleashed terrorists backed by Riyadh and its allies on the war-torn country. Yemenis believe that Riyadh wants to keep a hand on oil-rich provinces of their country, especially Marib. They say Saudis are advancing their agenda by backing terrorist groups with money and weapons. Latif al-Washali, Sana'a.
Hi, good morning.
Hello, good morning.
Good morning.
Morning, sir.
Half a kilo of Halim, please.
Hi,
kiddie. Good morning.
Number one, hands up. Number two, hands on the waist.
Hi, good morning.
Hi, good morning.
Get ready for jogging to warm up.
Hello, good morning.
Hello, good morning.
One loaf of well-baked bread, please.
Supplication on Saturdays. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Bismillah, words that seekers of sanctuary repeatedly recite, words that the very cautious in search of protection often repeat. I seek refuge with Allah, the Exalted above all, from the oppression of the unjust, from the deceitful malice the envious use to lay snares and traps, from the injustice and outrage of the tyrants, and I sing his praise. Do better and go beyond other praisers. O Allah, thou art one, has no partner, and is the Lord Master without being made. There is no discrepancy or nonsense in thy commands, nor there is lawlessness in thy kingdom. I beseech thee to send blessings on Muhammad, thy servant, thy messenger, to let me ask thee for enlightenment and inspiration, so as to be thankful for thy bounties, which alone get thy approval ultimately, to help me to obey thee and instinctively worship thee, and make me deserve thy rewards on account of thy very patronage. And have mercy on me, and prevent me from breaking in the bounds of thy prohibitions, as far as I am kept alive, and show the way unto that which is useful and advantageous till I go on survive, to let me take to heart the meanings of thy book, and by its reading throw down the heavy burden of sins, and receive welfare and salvation as a gift. Let not my family and friends who love me leave me alone. Let thy favors reach me in abundance during the remainder of my life, exactly as they used to be made available for me in full in the days gone by. O, the most merciful.
The debate.
Hello and welcome to Debate. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. 1 year has passed since 26-year-old Breonna Taylor was killed in her own home by Louisville, Kentucky police in a no-knock raid. She was an emergency medical technician who had no police record. On the anniversary of her brutal slaying, protesters have taken to the streets in several U.S. cities calling for justice. So far, none of the officers involved in her killing have been charged with the crime. Will this be just another dead black person where people call for justice but are unlikely to get it? I'd like to turn to Washington, D.C. and talk to Colin Campbell. Colin, good to have you with us. Well, tell us about what has taken place during this 1 year and also, of course, on the anniversary.
That's right. And we look at how much progress has been made since Breonna Taylor's death. And as we can tell, not much has been done. These people who are protesting are outraged over the constant ignorance and neglect of trying to find justice for Breonna Taylor, as there have not been any substantive arrests made in her death. We do know that there have been some money in a wrongful death lawsuit and things like that, but as far as really punitively punishing the people who are responsible for her death, the state has come very far short. Not to mention, we found out soon after the verdict came out that the Attorney General really did not provide the right amount of evidence or withheld certain pieces of evidence from being submitted that would render a verdict where Breonna Taylor would not get ultimate justice for being killed while being innocently in her home. And I think that's why you're seeing so many people who are frustrated and just angry and outraged at all of this, is because it could happen to any one of them. It could happen to any one of us, where you could be in your home doing something that you do normally every day, grabbing a pot of coffee, talking on the phone with a friend or a loved one, watching television, and you could be shot dead, and the person responsible for that could still walk around freely without any type of compassion or any type of punitive measure being served or any type of justice being rendered to the victim. And again, we are seeing these protests in Kentucky. We are seeing them in other parts of the United States as they look at other grievances that have come at the hands of police.
Thanks so much for that update, Colin Conwell. Staying in D.C., I'd like to welcome Matthew Fogg, former Chief Deputy U.S. Marshals Service. Matthew, thanks so much for being with us. Why does this just seem to repeat and repeat itself again? In your perspective, why haven't we seen any officer charged so far in the death of Breonna?
Well, thank you for having me on. Think one of the problems is the historical issues we have in this country with law enforcement, and especially people of color. We know that it's been disproportionately applied. We know that across the criminal justice system all the way. And the problem is in law enforcement, stuff having been in it for 30 years, officers can make mistakes. I got that. I understand that. But when you see it happening over and over again for the same happening when it's a race issue, it becomes a race issue, which racism is systemic in America now, and the president, everybody's admitted to it. The problem is, how do you hold people accountable? And you've got systems and institutions in place. These officers got a no-knock warrant. They went and knocked on went to Breonna Taylor's location and ended up mistakenly, whatever you want to call it. But the bottom line is she wound up dying in that process, and nobody was ever held accountable. And what we're seeing over and over again, and I saw it in my own self in law enforcement, it's very difficult to have the whole white officers actually accountable for killing black citizens. And there were always some, money is paid out, but there's no accountability. So, and as long as the system remains in its place, you will continue to have these type of incidents. And until the government and everybody comes together and says, listen, this is a race matter. We got to deal with it as a race matter. And people have to be held accountable if they do the wrong things. And I feel when you do the wrong things, somebody can get killed. So the bottom line is you got to start holding people accountable, and it seems like this system still is not ready to really hold culprits accountable for the things that when we do things wrong in law enforcement. Again, it's a race issue. It's going down party lines, race issues, when it seems to be an issue against black Americans, black and brown Americans.
Okay, stay with me, Matthew. Let me welcome my next guest, Yane Ndego, a writer, singer, and activist out of Philadelphia. Thanks so much for being with us. Well, you heard, hopefully, what Matthew was saying, that it is very difficult to see white officers being charged in the killing of black Americans. We know that the opposite, listening to interviewers before, of black police officers who are very careful, especially if before they want to fire at a white individual. But the other side of the coin is not the same. What is it going to take to change that status quo?
Well, I think we have to examine this from the core and from the root of where this comes from. And racism is definitely a key component, but racism is actually a tool of imperialism, of capitalism, of patriarchy. And those are the things that are really driving this. And the reason that the status quo is not being changed is because supports the elite in the U.S. and those people who are in the ruling class who actually benefit from the discrepancies in the ways that the legal system is applied depending on the parties that are involved. And so while police officers may make mistakes, the police as a larger overarching organization, agency, it's spoken as if it is here for to serve and protect all members of the community. But their really primary purpose is to protect the property owners, the people who have the most wealth. And so all of the issues of the dynamics around race actually support the stopping people from fighting against the class and capitalist issues that are in place in the U.S. because people will allow things to happen that that are inappropriate or that are wrong because it is because of their racism. And they will support things that are happening that are inappropriate because of their racism. And even if the system that is in place is not one that supports the best interest of most people in the country, and most working class people don't benefit from the current system that's in place. So we need to look deeper than even just the race concern. Race is significant, but we have to recognize it as a tool of the larger oppressive system that is used to keep working class and poor people disempowered and prevent them from working together.
Let me stay with you, Yanni, staying with what you just talked about as far as it being a class issue and it being a tool of imperialism. With that being the case, then why don't we see, for example, there obviously poor white individuals who are struggling, but in general we see this continuously targeting black people, and actually sometimes it could be black people who are wealthy or middle class. So tell me, how does that fit into what you're saying?
Well, because as I said, racism, I'm not suggesting that racism does not exist. Racism is embedded in our society in the United States. However, racism is intentionally embedded because it is a tool that is of the capitalist class. And so what ends up happening is that because there are individuals or groups of individuals, they serve almost as buffers against the ruling class. And so that is what the larger white community serves. That's how the larger white community serves. Its role is to actually keep the issues and the concerns of other communities. So it's kind of like a divide and conquer tactic. So you have like working class white peoples, their material interests are much more aligned with those of working class black people and working class brown people, but they fight against those individuals because of their association with whiteness, even though they don't actually gain a lot of the benefits of whiteness aside from certain much more superficial privileges. I mean, and substantial privileges like not having to be murdered by police, but by having the ability to feel that you can count on police and trust police and feel safe with police, it helps you to diminish looking at the realities that other communities are experiencing and work in collaboration with them to address the oppressive conditions that all working class and poor people face.
Okay, well, Matthew, in 2020, after George Floyd's murder, people across the U.S. took to the streets and saying Black Lives Matter and calling for accountability. What happened with that movement? Has anything changed?
I won't say necessarily that it's changed, because what I'm hearing is still Black Lives Matter. They're still continuing to gear up the protest and to try to do more things that change laws, regulations. We were just in Annapolis, Maryland, trying to get the policeman's law enforcement officer's Bill of Rights changed. But one of the things I know is, just like I'm the class agent, we've got a class discrimination lawsuit against the U.S. Marshals Service. All of the black agents, most of them in the Marshals Service, we're all in part of a class. You got a lot of class actions popping up all over the country in these law enforcement departments, which says internally we as the law enforcement officers recognize the racial disparities and the discrimination that's taking place within our departments. We don't want to do it anymore. We don't want to follow those patterns where you can see this, it's a pattern of discrimination and racial disparity. But when we speak out, of course, then the institution turns on us. So we are hoping now that more and more officers internally will speak out and will stop saying, no, we're not going to be serving and doing these no-knock warrants and things like this just in black communities. I've always said, if we did this stuff all over the country in the white communities where we serve drug warrants and everything else, this stuff would have stopped a long time ago. So what we have to understand is that we have to take a role, and that's where the law enforcement officers, I think, internally are beginning to step up to the plate, like I said, when we talk about these various law enforcement departments. So it is what the caller said. It is a problem that's deeply embedded that comes from a historical position in America on policing. But we can take control of it, those as black officers. And when we start speaking out and standing up and saying, along with the community, we join in with the community, we say, we're not putting up with this anymore.
Well, Matthew, staying with what you've just said, as far as black officers can bring about a change. However, I want to look at that, because if they go against the status quo, do you not think that they will be reprimanded and many times losing their jobs? I mean, we can widen this out, actually, and even look at, for example, the U.S. military, and many minorities play a big role in the U.S. military. And, of course, as Malcolm X said, and of course, Muhammad Ali, just sending poor people to fight other black and brown and poor people around the world. So is it realistic that a change can come from within?
I think it can. I mean, let me put it this way. I've been fighting the Marshal Service for, 30 years or so throughout my whole career. I won a major lawsuit against the Justice Department. There were some changes that was made. But again, and people are talking about it, but the dialogue has to be raised. And that's where when Black Lives Matter and with the pandemic and we had Donald Trump as president, we had things that lined up that said, this is the time. So I really think right now we're in an era. We got a new president. We got somebody that's with a new attorney general, somebody that's speaking this language and actually admitting that systemic racism exists and law enforcement exists in all aspects of our structural system, and we have to change it. Once you get people admitting it, and then you've got people coming forward afraid, not afraid they're going to lose a job, like I lost my job. I went through everything that you could imagine when I first stood up, and now we've got critical mass where people are coming out, and law enforcement, the professionals are coming out admitting it and testifying and saying, yes, I've observed this type of racism. I see it happening. I can tell you this person, that person is carrying it out. Now you start to see the other side where people had these racist views start to back up a little bit. We got a lot of police officers, law enforcement people that are part of these right-wing groups, the sympathizers that had these jobs and were happy. And now they're feeling a little antsy because they realize now that people are watching them and everybody's on notice. So I think this is a time for change, and I think that can happen.
Well, Yanni, how can the United States make the necessary changes to ensure equality when the capitalist system itself has been established via genocide and slavery? And to really bring about a change would mean basically dismantling the system itself. How do you see it?
Well, I mean, that's really the truth, and that's one of the reasons why the system fights against change as much as it does, and the agents of the system fight against that change. I am an organizer with Black Lives Matter Philly, along with the Black Alliance for Peace, the Black Philly Radical Collective, and Begin to Freedom. And one of the things that we say is there are no good cops in a racist system. And a lot of times people want to like try to boil down to individuals, but the individuals can't change the system. You move one person out with their good intentions. You have one person with their good intentions. You replace them with anybody else. You know, the system is the same. So even you replace a person with bad intentions with someone with good intentions, the system is the same. And so unless we dismantle the system, even when it comes to the extraction from other countries, the extraction from Africa, the entire African continent, if the U.S. and the Western forces want to stop those extractions, their entire economies would fall. And so there has to be a willingness amongst the people to imagine something completely new and different for all working class people. But the current system has poverty, it has violence, it has homelessness, it has those things embedded in them, because it's the only way that you can continue to take the resources and give and put them in the hands of a very few people and keep them there. And so once we begin to shift and shift from a completely systemic perspective and have people understanding that reality, which is the reason why I express the fact that this imperialism and capitalism are key and that racism is a tool to them. That's my perspective, that racism is a tool of these things and that it helps to keep the people divided. Once people overcome those things and begin to recognize that there is an enemy, that the enemy is actually those who are hoarding all of the resources from the people, and that these different militarized aspects of, or these militarized arms are actually human beings that are being used in order to diminish and to take the lives of and oppress the majority of people, not just in the United States, not even just black people, but around the world. We're not going to be able to see a difference. But we do have to still recognize that there is a substantial burden that is formed by the black and native people in the United States around this system. So even though there are people who are working class white people and poor white people that are actually suffering as well, because poverty, it goes across the board, there is an added burden that is borne by the people who are coming, who are of African descent, and the people who are native to the land, because they are needed to be the redirected as the enemies of the people, so that the people who do have the same common interests are fighting against each other and not challenging our true enemy in the ruling class.
Well, Matthew, now black people have been killed by figures of authorities for hundreds of years, and now in 2021, it's still happening. Now, there are more and more black activists who are looking at separatism as a way, believing that they will only get equity by establishing their own nation. Your take on that side of things?
Well, I think it's the expression, the cat's out the bag. I don't know if you can really try to set up a separate nation at this point, but you can set up a separate system that's determined that it will fight against racism and the issues that the fallout from it. Again, we're talking about George Taylor, Breonna Taylor, George Floyd, and Eric Garner. We can go on and on and on. And how in this current climate and world, and what I've seen, like I said, now what I'm seeing is if these officers are willing to come forward and law enforcement in that field, that's what we drove us to this point, willing to come forward and begin to identify the bigot cops. I'm writing a book, Bigots with Badges, and identify how we can fight the racism from within. I think we can start to see change. Now, of course, we know that our Congress and the great lawmakers in this country still, there's a racial divide, even when we look at the makeup of our Congress and everything else. And we start to address these issues seriously. Black Lives Matter, marching, coming out forward, because you've got to have protests, you've got to have people come forward and to put this thing on the front burner. And I just believe from that perspective, we will start to see changes, even with the marijuana laws, the drug laws, the things that we as cops was used all types of methods to just throw people in jail because we wanted to get our numbers up. A lot of that is going to start to change, and I'm seeing it now beginning to slowly but surely happen. So I think this is the time, and I thank God for your caller who is with Black Lives Matter, because I've always supported that particular movement, knowing that the purpose of it was to bring attention to all of this stuff. And that's the only way you're going to deal with it. Things have to be put on the front burner. We got to deal with it, and we got to let America know, us as employees, and when they try to utilize us to go against and to carry out these racist, these one-sided viewpoints, we say, no, we're not doing this anymore. We're going to stand up against it. And I think that's the viewpoint that we got to get across to America.
Well, Yanni, how do you think that the perspective that you were talking about, that basically you talked about, of course, the racial aspect of it, but in a capitalist system, it's more the haves and the have-nots, the 1% versus the 99%. So taking that in perspective, then, for example, there's a Secretary of Defense who's black, there's a Vice President who's black, but if they're supporting that same imperialist system, then color really doesn't matter. So with that being said, Yanni, do you think that more and more people are understanding the importance of the class differences, the importance of this basic war that's been declared against 99% by the 1%? And how key is that in your perspective for people to understand?
I think that there is an understanding. However, the reality of racism, the history of racism, and the differences in what people have experienced creates different interests and different levels of attachment to the current system, because people are unable to become empowered. So you do have black people who are in positions of power, they still act as agents of white supremacy, right? And so that doesn't get transformed. You do have changes that happen, but the changes are always done in a way that still helps to maintain the status quo. A perfect example is looking at the difference between, like, we had enslavement and now we have mass incarceration. Mass incarceration is just a new way to enslave people, and a lot of the labor that a lot of people labor in these prisons. They're basically free labor. They can be loaned out, And so what we have to do is we have to, as a people, we have to do the work internally to overcome the realities that have been programmed into us so that we can begin to stop functioning as agents of this oppressive system. And then we have to also recognize that we have to create completely new systems. We cannot just try to transform what's in place. We have to dismantle it and build something that cares for and takes care of everyone.
And on that note, I'd like to thank both of you for being with me, Yanni Ndogo, writer, singer, and activist out of Philadelphia, and Matthew Falk, former Chief Deputy U.S. Marshals Service out of Washington, D.C. And as always, we appreciate you being with us on another debate. I'm Marcia Hashimi.
This is IRIB English Radio. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
After having urged President Joe Biden to turn a temporary moratorium on new oil and gas leasing on federal lands and waters into a permanent ban on extracting climate-damaging fossil fuels from those areas, environmentalists criticize his administration's recent decision to not renew the Interior Department's policies limiting the provision of drilling permits. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Kenny Stansil Ryder. This article is published under the heading, Unfortunate, if not Unexpected. Biden criticized for resuming public land drilling permits. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. After having urged President Joe Biden to turn a temporary moratorium on new oil and gas leasing on federal lands and waters into a permanent ban on extracting climate-damaging fossil fuels from those areas, environmentalists criticized harshly Biden administration's decision recently to not renew the Interior Department's policies limiting the provision of drilling permits. In a statement released recently, Food and Water Watch Policy Director Mitch Jones called the news unfortunate, if not unexpected. Biden ran on a promise of stopping fracking and fossil fuel extraction on public lands, said Jones. Thus far, his orders have failed to live up that promise. Environmental justice groups, including Food and Water Watch, applauded the president in late January for instituting a pause on new oil and gas permitting on federal lands and waters, during which administration officials would review the climate impacts of, as well as taxpayer compensation for, public lands drilling, as reporters said. Pause on drilling and fracking is good news, but only if it is followed by a strong plan to permanently ban all dirty energy extraction on public lands, Food and Water Watch Executive Director Venona Hatter said at the time. The simple truth, Hatter said earlier this year, is that we need to stop drilling and fracking everywhere as soon as possible. The federal government has the power and the moral responsibility to get off fossil fuels, and doing so on publicly owned land sends a positive message that the Biden administration is serious about confronting this issue head-on. In response to the Biden administration's recent decision to resume processing permits for oil and gas drilling, which coincided with the Senate's confirmation of Deb Haaland, a proponent of curbing fossil fuel extraction on federal lands and waters, as Interior Secretary, Jones said, temporary pauses are not enough at all. Limiting those pauses to leases is not enough, he continued. Bending to the political pressure of the fossil fuel industry is completely unacceptable. We call on Biden to keep his promise, a full and complete ban on fracking and fossil fuel extraction on public lands. Full stop, Jones said. The climate crisis requires it, and he promised it. According to reports, the Biden administration recently said U.S. Bureau of Land Management, BLM, office staff would resume processing oil and gas drilling permits later this week, following a two-month period when those approvals were limited to senior officials in Washington. In an emailed statement, the Interior Department said BLM officials would process applications for permits and related sundry activities on valid existing leases in a timely manner. The department, which oversees BLM, also said it would begin providing monthly updates on pending and approved drilling permits on federal lands in an effort to improve and improve transparency for the industry and the public. On his first day in office, the administration of Biden stripped Interior Department agencies and bureaus of their authority to issue drilling permits. The order, which expires on March 21st, appeared to be a first step toward delivering on Biden's campaign pledge to ban new leasing on federal acreage, though permits have continued to be processed in Washington. Later in January, the administration paused new oil and gas leases, triggering criticism from the oil industry and Republican lawmakers. The Interior Department will launch a formal review of the program on March 25th, with a public forum. Federal mineral leasing was criticized heavily by environmentalists and Democrats during the administration of former President Donald Trump, who sought to maximize fossil fuel development on public lands.
Good morning. heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.